wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, part two of Bill Resnick's conversation with Jesse Hagopian about the Stop Woke Act. Economist Mary King speaks with Colleen Carroll, spokesperson for Eviction Representation for All. Jan Hocken remembers Darcel 15. And Larry Bolden reviews a novel by Barbara Kingsolver. First up, Bill Resnick talks to Jesse Hagopian, author of Teaching for Black Lives, about the situation in Florida, where Governor Ronald DeSantis aims to criminalize the teaching of black history. Part one aired last month on March 6th, if you'd like to hear it archived at kboo.fm. This is part two of that interview. Here's Bill Resnick speaking with Jesse Hagopian for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Hi, folks. In late February last, the Old Mole aired part one of an interview with Jesse Hagopian, a discussion of Florida's law. It's being copied by other red states. It bans, among other issues like sexuality, it bans the teaching of critical race history and many books. Jesse's a teacher at Garfield High School in Seattle, a lead activist in school in the Seattle Teachers Union, in the black teachers groups across the country. He's an influential and prolific scholar and writer, many articles, several books. Jesse recently edited the book Teaching for Black Lives, contributed some of the chapters, and added curriculum notes for the entire book. It's not yet banned on the bookshelves of Florida schools and libraries, but it surely will be soon. And teachers cannot just ignore that law and then get a gentle reprimand. The law is clever, insidious, has intimidated all but the most courageous and those without a mortgage and children. As Jesse commented, it's truly astounding that a teacher could face 5 years in prison and a $5,000 fine for having a book written by baseball great Hank Aaron on their bookshelf. It was banned because Aaron discussed the hatred that he faced throughout his career. Jesse then gave the lie to DeSantis' justification, pointing out social justice teachers teaching about race and racism aren't interested in shaming white students at all. In fact, they want to empower white students with the knowledge of important anti-racist traditions that exist among white people. He then added, there's a long tradition of anti-racist white people joining struggles for racial justice that I want my white students to know about, so they can make a decision about what side they want to be on in the struggles today. And I teach them they have a choice to make, right? They can go along with the status quo, or they can look at this incredible history and choose to join the struggles for justice today. Finally, last February, I asked Jesse in part one why they've made $10,000 and 5 years in jail for teaching black history. He replied, well, that's what these laws are about. They want to destroy black thought that challenges oppression. They want to destroy black studies, ethnic studies, critical race theory, and any other kind of framework that helps people understand how we can eliminate racism in our society. In part two, Jesse then continued his discussion about the governor and legislature, why they banned teaching the critical race theory and racism.
There are many levels to why these anti-history laws are being enacted in Florida and across the country. Most immediately, they wanted to halt the spread of anti-racist ideas amongst students. They saw this as an important wedge issue to use to rally their base for elections, trying to convince white parents that they should fear the indoctrination of their kids with these anti-racist ideas and use that to drive them to the polls to elect Republicans. They also want to privatize education. This has been a long-standing goal of both Democrats and Republicans. And Republicans seized on the opportunity to say that school is teaching white kids to hate themselves and their families, and so you should pull out of the public schools and use vouchers and charter schools to go to a school that won't teach your kids about race. And that is part of the strategy to break public education, to break the unions that help protect teachers. And I think all those are really important immediate causes of what's driving this attack on anti-racist education. But I also think it's deeper than that, because ever since the 1740, there has been an attack on black education, because in 1739, the Stono Rebellion occurred, which happened in South Carolina when an enslaved man named Jemmy helped to lead an uprising. And they marched with a banner that said liberty as they tried to fight for their freedom. And when that enslaved people uprising was put down, they were not only killed, but they wanted to kill the idea of freedom. They wanted to kill the ability of black people to ever write that word liberty again. And that's really what I think has carried through to this day. You know, they passed the first anti-literacy laws in South Carolina in 1740. Today, they aren't so bold as to ban the writing of the word, but they do want to ban racial literacy. They do want to ban the ability to envision a better society, to envision a multiracial democracy. And that's really what I think these laws are about. They want to eliminate systems of thought that challenge oppression. They want to destroy black studies and ethnic studies and critical race theory and any kind of framework that helps people understand how we can eliminate racism in our society.
Yeah, we shouldn't forget that, in fact, these laws also criminalize talking about transgender rights, any sympathetic portrayal of transgender people, and absolutely,
the Don't Say Gay law in Florida makes it a crime to simply talk about human sexuality in school, and they have outlawed transgender students from being able to play sports in Florida and in states across the country. And when they moved to ban the Black Studies program, the AP African American Studies class in Florida, one of the primary reasons that DeSantis gave for outlawing the Black History course is that it included the history of queer Black people. And he claimed that queer theory has nothing to do with Black history, which would be news to people like Bayard Rustin, a gay Black man who built the March on Washington. We wouldn't have the I Have a Dream speech that the right selectively quotes if it wasn't for Bayard Rustin's leadership, right? Marsha P. Johnson was a trans Black woman who led a rebellion against the police in 1969, the Stono Rebellion, that is what the largest demonstrations every year came from for LGBTQ people, right? The pride parades in every city are the result of the Stonewall Rebellion that Marsha P. Johnson helped to launch. I mean, we could go on and on with the immense contributions of Black queer people to our society. James Baldwin gave us some of the greatest novels in U.S. history. Lorraine Hansberry, a lesbian Black woman, gave us some of the greatest plays. So we can't talk about Black history without also talking about the contributions of Black queer people.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Hour on KABU 90.7 Independent Radio, Portland, Oregon, talking to Jesse Hagopian, a high school teacher, an activist and scholar and editor at Rethinking School and the Zen Education Project that published their magazine, Rethinking Schools, that features curriculums that engage students in critical study of American life. Jesse's book, Teaching for Black Lives, is one of those books not yet banned in Florida, undoubtedly will be. We've so far discussed the Florida law led by its Governor DeSantis. It seeks to clean Florida schools, pre-K, elementary, high schools, universities too, cleanse them of a wide range of subjects, critical race theory, and all manner of sexual expressions, especially any mention of LGBTQI. As to critical race theory, DeSantis accused it of teaching to hate whites. But indeed, it's the opposite, as Jesse pointed out. CRT teaches admiring some and not hating all whites. That is, those whites who fought for the abolition of slavery. When the white South then restored slavery, many whites fought the Jim Crow system. Today, of course, CRT welcomes whites, those who support black struggle for justice. DeSantis is either a malicious fool or a malicious opportunist, but he's had initial successes, indeed inspiring red states politicians to legislate their vision, which are also very troubling. But there are now signs of determined fight back around the country, especially in Florida. DeSantis may well discover exactly what he does not want, for his legislation has stimulated desire for ordinary folks to read the critique by black scholars and writers and get hold of the materials offered by organizations like Rethinking Schools and the Zen Project. And it's not just teachers reading those major works. Many parents and students, you know, church groups are becoming much more familiar with the critique and the solutions they offer. Jesse, you're part of Rethinking Schools and the Zen Education Project. They've gotten many, many requests for information asking what to do and how to do it, and for their curriculums and books. Tell us about it and about the growing resistance.
Yeah, it's been very encouraging to see a movement that's gaining strength against these anti-history laws. And many people are joining with Rethinking Schools and the Zen Education Project to help build this struggle. One of the initiatives that we started were study groups around the book Teaching for Black Lives that I co-edited with Diane Watson and Wayne Au. And that book has served as a text that's become a collective organizer. We have over 100 study groups across the country of educators, often in states where there are anti-history laws, who have come together around the book to learn what it means to teach for Black lives, how to teach kids about Black joy and Black contributions to our country, and also teach them about how structural racism has tried to deny that Black joy. And in these study groups, the teachers find commonality with others, and they get courage and strength to continue to teach the truth, in often in places where they are required to lie, but they refuse to do so. And we also offer a monthly online course that's free for anyone to come and learn about Black history. It's called Teach the Black Freedom Struggle with the Zen Education Project. And every month, myself or another host will interview a historian of Black history about different aspects of Black history that are often neglected, left out of the textbooks completely, or mistaught. And these classes draw hundreds of teachers from around the country to learn the truth about Black history so that they can teach it themselves in their classrooms. And we've also hosted several national days of action. On June 12th, we will host our third annual National Day to Teach the Truth, and we've had hundreds of educators from all around the country join in collective struggle on that day, doing walking tours in their community to teach each other about Black history in their own neighborhoods, or holding rallies at school boards or state capitals against these anti-truth laws. And students are increasingly getting organized. The Dream Defenders in Florida just yesterday held a national day of action against the banning of Black history. And we've seen student walkouts in Georgia, in Arkansas, and across the country of students who are demanding to be taught the truth about Black history and queer histories that are all too often left out of the curriculum.
Yeah, my guess and hope is that this could erupt a real national conversation about Black history and an enormous increase in studying Black history. Jesse, you've got the last word, and tell us how to get in touch with Rethinking Schools and all of the work they're doing.
Will do. I think that it's a very dangerous thing to tell students not to look at a book, because students are very curious people, and I think the Republican Party has miscalculated on this. telling them not to read Toni Morrison, telling them not to read W.E.B. Du Bois, telling them not to read these seminal texts that will transform their thinking, could lead them to being just curious enough to wonder why these powerful people didn't want them to read these books in the first place. And I think that is a path that could really transform the country. And Rethinking Schools and the Zen Education Project will be there every step of the way with young people who are challenging this censorship on their education. We will support them in every way we can. We have a quarterly magazine with Rethinking Schools at rethinkingschools.org, and we have at the Zen Education Project hundreds of free downloadable lesson plans that are available for educators and students to check out and learn more about the history that we all never got taught. So at the zeneducationproject.org, educators around the country are signing up every day. We have some 150,000 educators registered in states across the country who are getting people's history lessons that are one of the best ways to challenge these anti-truth laws. And I encourage everybody to find some way to join the movement. You can run for school board and challenge these anti-truth laws. You can join us on our National Day of Action in June, and you can let your legislators know that these laws don't speak for you and that you refuse to return to the days of McCarthyism when teachers could be labeled a communist and then just fired. Today, they've changed the label to a critical race theorist, but it is a very similar attack. And I'm so glad to be in the struggle with students, parents, and teachers all over the country who believe in a multiracial democracy and are refusing to allow that dream to be stolen by people like DeSantis.
Jesse Agopian, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
I know you'll be part of that struggle, an important resource for all of us. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too.
Think Tank on the Old Mole Variety Hour, the track titled Dialogues of the Carmelites, followed Bill Resnick talking with Jesse Hagopian, an educator at Garfield High School in Seattle. Again, you can find part one of that interview as part of the March 6, 2023 episode of the Old Mole Variety Hour. Search for that at kboo.fm. Up next, economist Mary King speaks with Colleen Carroll, spokesperson for Eviction Representation for All, about how destructive evictions are for families and the community, and how the proposed ballot measure could reduce evictions by providing a range of supports, including legal representation. Here's Mary King for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Morning, everybody. This is Mary King. I'm a retired economist from the Portland State Economics Faculty, and I'm here with Colleen Carroll to talk to you about the Eviction Representation for All campaign going on in this community now. Before we get started, let me just thank KBOO and the Old Mole Show for having us on and helping us get the word out to the community. Colleen, could you introduce yourself to us and tell us a little bit about the measure and what's in it?
Sure. Thanks so much for having this conversation with me, Mary. My name is Colleen Carroll, and I'm one of the volunteer organizers and spokespeople with the Eviction Representation for All campaign. We are the Yes on Measure 26-238 campaign, which is a ballot measure that will be on the May 16th ballot in Multnomah County. Our campaign is a coalition of groups and organizations that have been working on this policy for about 2 years now, coming out of, you know, the worst of the eviction crisis through COVID and through to seeing actually that evictions have been causing harm in our community, you know, the whole time before COVID and past COVID. So in addition to the groups that have been working on this, like I said, for about 2 years now, the campaign has over 40 endorsers now. So our coalition is large and it's growing. And people and organizations who are seeing the ways displacement and eviction really cause harm and disrupt our communities. So housing advocacy groups, labor unions who are seeing it both for their members, but also right for teachers unions who are seeing it impact their students, faith communities who have been gathering and really asking what can their communities be doing to address the housing crisis, as well as many other community-based organizations, specifically frontline organizations who have been in the community helping tenants, apply for that rental assistance, get that safe harbor, all of the things that we've needed to do to keep ourselves safe over this past 2 years. That whole, 40 plus organizations have gotten around this measure to say this makes sense and we need it in our community.
That's fantastic. And I understand this is something that's happening in other cities as well. What elements of policies from other places have you pulled into this measure specifically?
At its heart, our measure, Eviction Representation for All, is what's called a right to counsel measure. Right to counsel, maybe people, think, oh, that's the thing that we have. It's a constitutional guarantee, right? The right to a lawyer. And at a federal level and in the Constitution, that only applies to criminal cases, right? So if you are charged with a crime, you have the right to a lawyer. Many, many, many things that deeply impact our lives take place in the legal system, but they take place in the civil court system. And eviction is one of those things. And in civil court, there is no federally or state guarantee to a lawyer. And so for tenants who are facing an eviction, who go to the courtroom to fight for their housing, they have no legal representation on their side, and they have to do all of the bureaucratic and process and legalese stuff, on pace with the court's pace, not their pace, right? And they have to do it alone. And on top of that, they are facing another side who almost always has a lawyer. Landlords almost always have a lawyer or an agent, somebody who is a professional at doing this, and tenants are by themselves. And so just off the bat, it creates this massive disparity in how what should be, what we like to think of as a fair and balanced adjudication absolutely is not, because you cannot be fair and balanced when one side is, fluent in the language of the court and the other side is terrified, there for the first time, and really, really stressed out and alone. So there's no way that that can be fair. So right to counsel came out of the tenants movement and people who were directly, seeing the impacts of the eviction court, not just of eviction, but eviction court in New York City. So a tenant-led coalition pushed really, really hard to develop and fight for a civil right to counsel in eviction court. And it passed in New York in 2017. And that really started a movement across the United States, which is now known as the Tenants' Right to Counsel movement. And we have seen policies like the one that started in New York and have been growing and expanding and, being packaged to meet the need of the community in different places. And so I think we're up to over 16 jurisdictions now that have tenant right to counsel. New York started in 2017 and kind of slowly this place and that place added up. Then COVID hit. And all of a sudden, the reality of how precarious so many tenants are across the United States and in Multnomah County also really hit home for people, right? We're one paycheck away. Being late 1 month on rent, we're that couple days late away from being kicked out of our homes. So the precarity really became clear. And in the 2 years where COVID and COVID protections kind of cracked open possibilities, lots more jurisdictions created either pilot programs or passed real full civil right to counsel measures. And here in Multnomah County, we are looking to those, we're looking to build on them and right size it to our community. And that's how we came up with Eviction Representation for All.
I did see recently the last posting for the proportion of tenants who had counsel in eviction court in January 2023 was 2%, 1 in 50. So really low, despite the fact that we've got existing programs. So For Portland and Multnomah County, you're following up on things that people have learned elsewhere, things that people have piloted elsewhere. And as I understand it, it's not just having an attorney in court with people. It's also other supports and services that I believe you've included in this measure. Can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. Legal representation really matters and makes a huge difference in reducing evictions and preventing the worst outcomes. Legal representation paired with emergency rental assistance and paired with tenant outreach and able to be instituted earlier on in the process, those are the things that what we call an ecosystem of eviction prevention will really address. And that's different than just winning a case in court. I think that there's a conception that tenant right to counsel is about winning a case in court. While it matters to reduce the amount of judgments of eviction, it actually matters to look back to the whole process of an eviction, starting from the notice of termination, and intervene as early as possible. And so our policy does just that. We have created a tenant resource office in at the county, and that resource office will be responsible for managing the program and taking in notifications of termination. So that immediately, right when the tenant gets it, within 24 hours, the program is notified and the legal representation teams that can intervene before the court is even gotten involved. And I think that's really important to think about. How many of these cases could we work out and mediate before a filing has even happened? Right to Counsel talks about different measures of success, reducing filings, less cases in court, and handled ahead of time, as well as less judgments of eviction. And that's the other thing that this program does really well, which is there's a, you know, about a 15-day window from when you get that summons to court to when your trial date that you have the opportunity to negotiate with your landlord. In kind of simple legal terms, often referred to as a settlement, if you've ever heard somebody say, oh, I settled that case, right? It means it didn't go to a trial. That's how almost all eviction cases end in our community, either by default, which means the landlord won just because they showed up, no merit to the case at all, or more likely, they go through a process of stipulated agreements. And that what happens in Multnomah County is the tenant shows up, you're at your first appearance, and the judge says, welcome, hello, here's the thing. You can either go out into the hallway and talk to your landlord's lawyer for 5 minutes and come back and let me know what you've agreed to, or you can go to trial. Oh, and by the way, if you go to trial, you risk taking on the legal fees of the winning side. So tenants, again, think, well, that seems like a worse outcome than just losing my home. If I'm going to lose my home, I don't also want to pay this guy's legal fees. So you step outside into the hallway and you have that 3 to 5 minute negotiation, which, I mean, is just basically coercive. And so those stipulated agreements are really heavily weighted towards the landlord. They often don't give enough time to work out the things, right? Things like, hey, I'm applying for rental assistance, and that takes some time. So these stipulated agreements are great tools, but our purpose is to make them durable and fair. When the tenant's legal team and the landlord's legal team can negotiate that lawyer to lawyer, you know, that's where we see a lot of the statistics about tenant right to counsel keeping people in their homes. Yeah, in short, I really appreciate the way Kim McCarty, who is the ED of Community Alliance of Tenants, talks about this, that evictions should be rare and they should be fair. And that's what all together this package does.
So in that latter part there, you're addressing this idea of invisible evictions. Mm. What do people mean when they talk about that?
When we talk about counts and amount of evictions, what we're looking at is how many cases have been filed with the court. Unfortunately, that is not all of the evictions that are happening, because there's a step before that called the notice of termination. And that's the piece of paper your landlord sends you in the mail or puts on your door, you know, that states, says notice of termination, your lease is being terminated, you must move out. And lots of people think, I can't fight this, right? And so when you move out at that stage, that's often called a self-eviction, and there's no record of it. The only time we see an eviction in court is when the tenant doesn't leave, because often it's 72 hours, right? That's how long for non-payment is right now. So when a tenant is unable to move within 72 hours and unable to come up with the money that is owed because rental assistance applications are taking too long or whatever it is, then it gets filed with court and then your first appearance gets set. But that notice of termination to summons stage is the invisible period and where lots of displacement is happening and where we would like to intervene. And this, our program makes that possible.
And how does the eviction representation for all program make it possible to prevent the invisible evictions?
By requiring that landlords file those notices of termination with the tenant resource office so that the legal and tenant outreach teams can reach out to that person at that point.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, can we switch gears a little bit? I'm hoping you can tell everyone a bit more about the impacts of eviction. What happens to families as a result of being evicted?
Yeah, there's definitely a growing body of study. Taking it out of thinking of this as a single event that just happens and then it's done, and seeing it as a long process of stress, of trauma, and often cyclical. So it's this kind of constant stress for many, many renters. It has huge impacts on our health, and that's part of a really interesting body of study connecting eviction to both public health and individual health outcomes. There are also massive impacts on children. They are dealing with the stress of their their parents being stressed out. And when an eviction happens, because our housing dictates our schooling, many, many students are pulled out of their school, are pulled out of their community, their friend group, and uprooted. And that has a huge impact. Short-term and long-term impacts are being studied more. And basically all of it says it's not good and it's not necessary. There are other ways to mediate these issues.
I was just going to say, throwing people out of their homes, that's so drastic. Yeah. And I know that economists say that, yes, it happens to people who are already experiencing some level of financial or health stress, but the fact of eviction itself increases poverty rates, increases unemployment, lowers incomes, it increases hospitalizations, which has a whole impact on the community as well then.
Yeah, I think, about families that are evicted and displaced, and that is the, catalyst, one of the parents losing their jobs because where they have to move to is off transit, is harder to get to, right? So then you lose a job you already have, not to mention the eviction on your record, which means that less and less landlords are willing to rent to you, and you're pushed to the more illegal and less desirable units that become available to you.
I've also read that it is not applied evenly, that landlords particularly tend to evict women. Mm-hmm. They particularly tend to evict Black families. They particularly tend to evict families with more children. So regardless of, say, your rental history and what you might owe, eviction itself is still a selective kind of process that's pretty discriminatory.
Yeah, the number one predictor of an eviction is having a kid in the home. And there's great recent research that's been published through the Eviction Research Network that have analyzed Oregon's data specifically. And much like the rest of the country, it is Black families and Indigenous families that are most often evicted.
And then I know that there are the sort of cold-blooded economic analysis about, yes, well, this also puts up public spending because we have to pay for more shelters and more foster care and more emergency room visits and XYZ, so that actually avoiding that public expenditure, but paying for attorneys, the community comes out ahead. It's one of those things that more than pays for itself.
Yeah.
Which is appalling that we have to bring that up, but maybe helpful.
Creating a dedicated funding stream that says this is something we're committing to is part of the part of the policy. When we came up with this capital gains tax, it really made sense because we don't need, that much money, and being able to target a very small increase on, this unearned income really made sense.
I think it was a really good choice on the part of the campaign to pick that capital gains income tax. And the reason is that while eviction prevention on the one end helps reduce economic inequality by keeping people included in the economy, the capital gains income goes overwhelmingly to very affluent and very white households. It's a very privileged group of people, and it's a very small tax on them. It's less than 1%. So people don't realize that economic inequality in and of itself is a real issue here locally. Income inequality hit a record high in Oregon in 2020, and we just don't know the more recent numbers. Really, a capital gains income tax is a tax on the income from sale of wealth, from the sale of an asset. It means that the tax take will vary, so you need to have a big reserve. If you want to tax at the top, the take is going to vary. So you just plan for that. It's not a big deal. And then the other thing that people forget or don't realize in the first place is the way that the tax burden has been shifted off people really who have the ability to pay and pushed down the income scale to where it means people pay a fee like a gas tax and they have to wait to replace their kids' outgrown shoes. We're really effectively in the rich world, a low tax country. And in the top federal income tax rate since Ronald Reagan has never been as high as 40%, whereas we spent 50 years in the 20th century with it above 70% and 20 of them above 90%. Wow. You know, people think, oh, those were the glory days, the 50s and 60s, the economy was working so great. Yeah, guess what the tax rate was at the top? You know, we should go back to that.
The other thing that when you were talking, it really made me think about what's an acceptable, you know, year over year raise, right? We talk about taxes because they happen annually, right? So next year, you know, I might have to pay less than 1% more on earnings, right, from the sale of stocks and bonds. But what is for sure, is the increase on my rent that's happening. And that's 14%. I just over and over want to ask, why is it so terrifying to think about a raise on taxes of less than 1% and the concept that every tenant is getting an at least 14% raise? As we've been seeing in the news, there are lots of exceptions to that. I will be priced out of this apartment eventually because my wages aren't going up that much.
No, that's really a good point. The rent control cap that the state of Oregon put on and preempted the localities from having their own rent control allows such high rent increases, both the rate of inflation plus 7%, whereas nobody's getting raises like that. Colleen, while we've got you, can you tell us more about the campaign and especially how people can get involved? I know the election's coming up in May, right?
That's right. Yeah. So May 16th, we're on the ballot. And so I really encourage everybody who's listening, if you're a voter, look for that special election ballot. We are the Yes on 26238 campaign. Like I said, we're a coalition of organizations that have been working on this for a long time, and we're always growing. And so if you, if listeners are a member of a neighborhood association, a faith community, a bowling league, you know, all of these places that you're in conversations with other people, talk to them and say, hey, have you heard about eviction representation for all? Send them to our website. Email us. We would love to come do a presentation. We invite people to want to know more because I think by understanding what the eviction process really entails, we begin to see that this is preventable and it's also a problem. Visit our website, eratenants.org. Check us out on social if that matters, right? If you're somebody who loves to see a cute picture of canvassers. And speaking of canvases, that's the community footwork. And so if you've never canvassed before, it's a great way to learn the process of like direct democracy, the closest thing we have to direct democracy through ballot measures. And so if you're able to and interested, please give a donation. You can do that on our website as well.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to the Old Mole. And we really appreciate the opportunity from the Old Mole Soul to let people know about the Eviction Representation for All campaign and get the word out. Because just as you say, this is a people power campaign. People need to hear and know about it. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Loaded by DJ Quiet Storm, following Mary King and Colleen Carroll for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, Jan Hocken pays tribute to Darcel 15. The world's oldest working drag performer, who died at 92 years of age this month on March 23rd. Portland's Darcel was an activist, author, playwright, actor, costume designer, and owner and headliner of the Darcel 15 Showplace. Here's Jan Hocken for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Darcel 15, also known as Walter Cole, died on March 23, 2023, at the age of 92. Although she lived a long and full life, I share the grief of so many over her passing. I've known Darcel for 20 years, when she and her partner, Roxy, agreed to be part of Queens of Heart, my documentary that explores the social psychology of drag performance, and is set at the Darcel 15 Showplace in Portland. The film opens with Roxy musing on the therapeutic work they do at the club, with Darcel quipping, "And we don't get a damn dime for it." The subtitle of the film, Community Therapists in Drag, is both playful and pointed. The performers do indeed help audiences with the intense emotions that arise in this famous drag club, and specifically anxieties around gender and sexuality. And as we say in the film, this work requires a deep understanding of human psychology. Queens of Heart grew out of a class I taught years back on psychoanalysis, gender, and film at Portland State University. Students were looking for a research setting to pursue key themes taken up in the course, particularly the idea of gender as masquerade, a concept introduced by psychoanalyst Joan Riviere and developed further by feminist film theorists in the 1970s and 80s. While many of the students had been to the club, few realized its extensive involvement in civic work and activism, from gay rights to healthcare and poverty issues. But the feminist concept of gender as a performance was very much on display. When we began filming interview reactions at the club, I asked people about their responses to the performance. The typical response was, "They are so funny." When I probed further, people often expressed annoyance. But we were very much interested in the politics of humor in drag settings. Women are keenly aware of the hostile element in sexist jokes, where the guy rebuffs a complaint with "just kidding," or "you can't take a joke." The question for us as feminist filmmakers centered on identifying who pays the price of the joke in drag performances. Was it gay men, women, or gender in general? We decided that the drag performed at Darcel's parodied rigid patriarchal gender codes. As a psychologist and documentary filmmaker, I've been interested for some time in forms of work that are typically not taken seriously. Drag performance is one such form of work. The campy type of female impersonation carried out night after night for 60 years at this club is deeply appreciated by locals, but the skills behind the craft are sometimes overlooked. In making Queens of Heart, we set out to expose the work behind the act and also to turn the tables on audiences. Many people come to Darcel's ask, why do they do it? But as filmmakers, we were more interested in pursuing the question of why do they come? Part of the reason they come, we found, is that they are seeking something from the performers they cannot find elsewhere, a chance to acknowledge the anxieties and absurdities of sex, whether gay or straight, and to vicariously play with gender, suspending for a night the rigid boundaries between masculine and feminine. Young heterosexual women, the largest demographic group served by the club, tend to come in groups, particularly as bachelorette parties. Anxiety about getting married, over the domestication of desire that follows the day of celebration, makes freedom from constraints part of the last night out. Gay men offer an unthreatening place to act out the bad girl left behind in entering the role of the good wife. Young women, many from conservative Christian communities, routinely commented on how feel they free at the club. They described how female friends and family members had prepared their elaborate bad bride costume. "Is being a bride kind of like being a drag queen?" I sometimes asked. Many of the bachelorettes conferred among themselves before deciding on a response. No one went one young woman solemnly informed me. Being a drag queen is more like being free, but being a bride is more like real life. In her interactive routines, Darcelle would often weave straight and queer jokes into the act. Have you heard that the lesbian basketball team finally got a sponsor? Snap-on Tools. Did you know the AMA reported a new study on Americans and their favorite position for having sex? It's the doggy position. He begs and she rolls over and plays dead. The audience roars. Did you know that there's a new club in Las Vegas where two animal tamers manage 30 tigers? Yes, 30 tigers, folks. That's a lot of puss for two gay guys. Audiences are carried across the threshold between queer and straight sex, just as they are across the boundary of sexual difference. Sex is absurdly funny, Darcelle suggests through this joke work, whatever the mix of body parts and sex people involved. We in Portland have been incredibly lucky to have had Darcelle 15 in our community for so many decades, and who, like a strong mother, encourages us to stand up to mean-spirited right-wing politics. As drag performances are once again targeted by reactionary politicians in regions of the country, we need to join in solidarity with these more visible members of the queer community. And we can draw on the spirit of Darcelle as we also poke fun at their hypocrisies and pious moral outrage. This is Jan Hawken, remembering Darcelle 15 for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Don't you love a farce? My fault
I fear. I thought that you want what I want. Sorry, my dear. Where are the clowns? And in the clowns. Just when I saw opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance begin with my usual way, sure of my love. No one is there. Is it bliss? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career. But where are the clowns? There ought to be clowns. Well, maybe next year.
Thank you, buddy.
And that was Darcelle 15 singing Where Are the Clowns, along with the Judy Collins version, from a performance last year at Portland's Darcelle 15 Showplace, following Jan Hawken, remembering Darcelle 15 for the Old Mole Variety Hour. To watch the documentary mentioned in that last segment called Queens of Heart, it can be streamed online at jhawken.com or by visiting the webpage for today's show at kboo.fm. Finally, this episode, Book Mole Larry Bolden reviews Barbara Kingsolver's 2022 novel, Demon Copperhead. Here's Patricia Kohlberg reading for Larry Bolden.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and today I'm reading Larry Bolden's review of Barbara Kingsolver's 2022 novel, Demon Copperhead. The best way to introduce you to young Demon Copperhead is to let him announce his entrance. First, I got myself born. A decent crowd was on hand to watch, and they've always given me that much. The worst of the job was up to me, my mother being, let's just stay out of it. On any other day, They'd have seen her outside on the deck of her trailer home, good neighbors taking notice, pestering the trouble as they will, all through the dog breath air of late summer and fall, cast an eye up on the mountain, and there she'd be, little bleached blonde smoking her Pall Malls, hanging on that railing like she's captain of her ship up there, and now might be the hour it's going down. This is an 18-year-old girl we're discussing, all on her own and as pregnant as it gets. The day she failed to show, it fell to Nance Peggott to go bang on the door, barge inside, and find her passed out on the bathroom floor with her junk all over the place and me already coming out, a slick, fish-colored hostage picking up grit from the vinyl, worming and shoving around because I'm still inside the sack that babies float in pre-real life. Mr. Peggott was outside idling his truck, headed for evening service, probably thinking about how much of his life he'd spent waiting on women. His wife would have told him the Jesusing could hold on a minute. First, she needed to see if the little pregnant gal had got herself liquored up again. Mrs. Peggott, being a lady that doesn't beat around the bushes, and if need be, will tell Christ Jesus to sit tight and keep his pretty hair on. She came back out yelling for him to call 911 because a poor child is in the bathroom trying to punch himself out of a bag. End quote. Here is Barbara Kingsolver showing her genius again, managing to take on the voice of a young boy and keeping that voice with all its grammatical blunders and peculiar wording for 700 pages of monologue. I can imagine writing a short story in the voice of my younger self, but to be able to convincingly hold that voice, not just for a short story, but for a very long novel, simply astounds me. There is no way I could do justice to sketching out the whole story of Demon's life, but I could easily assemble a series of terse bits of advice he gives to the reader. Although it says his name is Damon Fields on his birth certificate, quote, did she think she'd even get me off her before people turned that into Demon? And once he got his copper wire hair, he became Demon Copperhead. Like Dickens' David Copperfield, Demon is passed from foster home to foster home and works dangerous, low-paying jobs from the age of 8 on. His mother loses custody and regains it several times, but takes in stray men one after another. The worst of these men, Stoner, beats on both him and his mother until Demon is taken from her by Children's Services. Says Demon, at the time, I thought my life couldn't get any worse. Here's some advice. Don't ever think that. Demon's great talent is drawing, and he loves to draw superheroes. He draws his friends and tells them what superpowers they have. While he is with one family, the McCobbs, Mrs. McCobb takes him to Walmart, and using money he has made sorting junk for a junk dealer, she buys him new clothes, not so much for him, but to protect her family's good name. Quote, but at school the next day in my new clothes, I still felt horrible, not even proud. Embarrassed, honestly, because nothing would change. Now they'd all think I was just that much more pitiful because of trying. Loser is a cliff. Once you've gone over, you're over. End quote. At one point, in desperation, he seeks out his grandmother, hoping to be taken in and cared for. Quote, my grandmother had no use for anything in the line of boys or men, any of them that stands up to make water, was how she put it. Bad news for me. End quote. Still, his grandmother, his father's mother, does provide for him, and an uncle who lives with her encourages his art and provides sage advice when others only laugh at or curse him. While Demon's life is sad and his very existence precarious, this novel is often humorous, and Kingsolver's wisdom shines through. She exposes the many stereotypes applied to hill country miners, so-called hillbillies, and looks long and hard at opiate addiction. In her afterword, she acknowledges her debt to Charles Dickens. She writes, "I'm grateful to Charles Dickens for writing David Copperfield. His impassioned critique of institutional poverty and its damaging effects on children in his society. Those problems are still with us. In adapting his novel to my own place and time, working for years with his outrage, inventiveness, and empathy at my elbow, I've come to think of him as my genius friend. Over the years, I've come to see Kingsolver as my genius friend, and this novel cements that view. I've been talking about Barbara Kingsolver's 2022 novel, Demon Copperhead. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I'm Patricia Kohlberg, reading this morning for Larry.
This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour for April 3rd, 2023. I'm John Nelson with an announcement before we go. Washington State University's 4th annual SJCon Social Justice Conference is coming up on April 21st and 22nd. The online event is entitled Native Sovereignty, Decolonization, Divestment, Reparations, and Environmental Justice, Constructing Coalitions at the Intersections. The conference, which is free and open to the public, features panels on missing and murdered indigenous people, man camps, and fossil fuels, food sovereignty as environmental justice, the role of indigenous traditional ecological and cultural knowledge in decolonizing academia and nurturing healthy futures through first foods and plant relatives, indigenous black solidarity, and more, with a screening and discussion with the filmmaker of Jan Hocken Films' Atomic Bamboozle. The event is sponsored by WSU Vancouver Native Studies, the Collective for Social and Environmental Justice, and PSU Indigenous Nations Studies, among others. We'll post the link to the conference website when we post the show. Email desiree.helligers at wsul.edu for more information. Thanks to Larry Bolden, Patricia Kohlberg, Jan Hocken, Mary King, and Bill Resnick, and to their guests Colleen Carroll and Jesse Hagopian. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in time at kboo.fm. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.